Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to ICO 101, a Crypto 101 podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Paul.
What we do here is go back.
At ICO 101, we look at initial coin offerings, security token offerings, utility token offerings, and general crowd sale offerings from an average consumer's perspective. We preview pre- and post-sale offerings while engaging with the leaders of those companies in order to help you make an informed decision on how you want to participate in these tokens, securities, or initial coin offerings. ICO 101 Podcast is on the Crypto 101 Podcast feed, so please find Crypto 101 Podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and CastBox. Leave a positive rating and subscribe to it. It helps us stay in the top charts. Visit our website at ICO101podcast.com. I'm very active on Twitter, so please follow me there at @SupAaronPaul. While you're there, follow the show at ICO 101 Podcast. Send me all the private messages you want. I love getting them, and I try to respond as fast as I can. And just as a reminder, folks, I'm not a professional investment institution, bank, lawyer, or accountant. I'm not offering any legal, accounting, or financial advice, so please make sure you listen, take notes, research, and make your own informed decision. My last preview looked at Formosa Financial. As a follow-up to that preview, I have on today Ryan Tarablini, the co-founder and CEO of Formosa Financial. It was pretty cool to be able to ask him the questions I had in the preview. His patience and willingness to answer my 101 questions was much appreciated. As always, your feedback is also appreciated, so please reach out if your heart desires about this episode or anything else. Both me and the show can be found on Twitter, @SupAaronPaul or @ICO101Podcast. So without further ado, please welcome Ryan Tarablini of Formosa Financial. Ryan Tarablini of Formosa Financial, welcome to ICO 101.
Thank you for having me.
Let's just get after it, man. So we already did the preview on the company. I introduced the team because I think that your team is very strong. And like I said on the preview, I normally don't go through the team at the top, but I was pretty impressed. So Ryan Tarablini, tell us about yourself.
Sure. So Ryan Tarablini from the Bay Area, San Francisco area, grew up around Silicon Valley. After, you know, getting my public education here, went to University of California, Berkeley. And that was right at the kind of beginning of the financial crisis in 2008. So not the best time to graduate from college. But given that tech was relatively less affected than other sectors of the economy, I did what most people did and tried to find a job at a startup. So that was kind of the beginning of my journey in tech. And then I was lucky enough to work at Google for 4 years on Android. That was kind of the early days when the first phones were coming out. Mm-hmm. The app and developer ecosystem wasn't particularly strong then. So trying to catch up with Apple and what they were doing. And then the 4 years I spent there, by the time I left, you know, there's a billion apps on the store. We had a global business, and that was kind of the beginning of my journey into blockchain. So long, long path through technology from the mobile app ecosystem all the way into what's going on in blockchain now.
Before we talk about your blockchain, I've had several guests on now, I guess. Several might be too much. I've had a few who have worked for Google. What's the hiring process to get into Google?
I think it varies depending on what role you're applying for. For me, it was consisting of a few phone interviews and then I think 4 or 5 on-site interviews, not like all on-site interviews within the same day. So you interview with different managers, different people that would be your colleagues, and they ask you kind of a series of theoretical questions, but also a series of like tactical questions. So it's more like a way to assess your critical thinking skills, I'd say, is what they focus on in the hiring process. And then they assess your googliness, whatever that means. So I guess I passed that test.
At that time, you're talking 2008, 2009, was Google as competitive to get in as it is today?
I don't know if it was more competitive or less competitive, because Google's, I mean, when I was there, Google had like maybe 20,000 employees, and now it's like 80,000 globally. So I don't know if I don't know what the admit rate is like. I don't know if they're getting more applicants or what the deal is, but it was, not that easy to get a job there, I would say.
And you were what number were you in Ripple?
I was around 30. I joined Ripple about a year after the company had been founded. So they had launched the Ripple protocol late 2012, and then I was talking to them late 2013, and then I joined at the beginning of 2014.
So what got you into that? What got you into blockchain first, and then why Ripple?
Yeah, so it actually stems back to my time at Google. So when I was at Google, my role was creating and enforcing the policies on Google Play, the App Store. So like, what can apps do with your data? What can apps do from an advertising perspective, from a payments perspective? And one of the big areas of enforcement was payments, because Google wants its 30% of the rev share on any app sold. So I had seen some developers actually integrate Bitcoin into their app as a way to circumvent Google's payment system. So I said, "Oh, what's this Bitcoin thing?" I kind of heard of it before. So then I started looking more closely into it. I thought, "Oh, that's quite interesting," because at the time, one of Google's challenges was finding ways to monetize users in emerging markets, since the only payment methods Google supported were debit cards, credit cards, and those type of things. So I thought, "Oh, this blockchain innovation might be an interesting way for new developers to come into the system and monetize their apps." So then I looked at Ripple, and Ripple has some very, very different capabilities compared to Bitcoin's blockchain. So that got me pretty intrigued. And then I happened to have had a colleague at Google who had just gone to Ripple. So we got in touch, and we happened to be neighbors in San Francisco. And then
Nice.
the rest is history.
There you go. So how did Formosa come to be? How did you and George get hooked up? And what made the two of you decide, hey, Formosa needs to be in my next project. I'm going to bounce. I'm going to move to Taiwan. I'm going to leave Ripple. And here we are today.
Yeah, so long story short, I had spent some time in Taiwan before, actually, when I was on my team at Google. So that was our headquarters for Asia operations for China, Japan, and Korea. So I'd always really had a really strong fascination and affinity for Taiwan. And last year, I was in Oxford getting my master's degree in public policy at the School of Government. So I had really thought a lot about Taiwan's history and how much I really appreciated doing things in Taiwan. So I said, I really need to go back, set up a business. The blockchain space is just getting started, and I've got good experience and good connections there. So went back to Taiwan. I've been friends with the CEO of the Bitcoin exchange there for some years. And at the time, Jeffrey Huang, who's a famous entrepreneur and rapper there,
I
he
interviewed
was
Jeffrey.
doing the Mithril project.
Yeah, I interviewed him. He was like interview number three for ICO 101 podcast.
Nice. So I'm with good company now. You get all the best projects from Taiwan. Yeah, so he's awesome. So basically, I was just had just got back from grad school. I was kind of figuring out what to do next. Linked up with him, and he's got really strong backing from investors there, and very connected at every level. So said, "Hey, I want to do this thing in Taiwan." Something around the concept of providing banking services to people in the blockchain space. And he said, "Oh, I know just the guy. I know this guy George. We've known each other since high school in California, and he's three-term legislator. His family's got connections with banks." So I said, "Wow, okay, great. Let's talk to him." And then we hit it off. So it's been going on like that since February.
Awesome. Formosa Financial is a financial service platform for all blockchain innovators. What does that mean? And what's the problem that blockchain innovators have that Formosa is going to solve?
Really, what it means is, we're a lot of what happens in the blockchain space, you kind of think of it like a parallel financial universe, right? So, traditional finance, obviously, people are moving in and out of cash or equities or other types of traditional assets, right? But what we've seen in 2017, even before that, right? Even Ethereum itself was kind of like a public ICO, right? They raised a bunch of Bitcoin. They created this amazing new blockchain, Ethereum. And now people are using that as the foundation to start all these new projects. But they're all raising this in Ethereum, which is a highly volatile asset, right? So if you were running a startup, say in Silicon Valley, you'd go raise your funds from venture capitalists, you'd open your corporate bank account, and you'd have cash in there, right? But in the new kind of ICO world that we're living in, you raise 40,000 Ether, then the price of it, just last week alone, right? Prices dropped 30%. So then you have 30% less runway. So how do you really manage your runway? How do you manage your cash flow efficiently when you're working with such volatile assets? So that's the problem we're looking to solve.
I feel like I'm quite familiar with what you guys are trying to do in terms of, or the reasons why banks wouldn't do business with blockchain companies, but why wouldn't they? And if banks, and I also asked this on the preview too, I was just kind of thinking, I was kind of musing, like banks don't want to do business with blockchain companies. Like, why does that matter anyways as well? Like, if a person wants to get in the blockchain early, then they have to know where the market is, right? Where it's mature, where it's not. And if somebody's working for a blockchain company, one would have to presume there are monetary risks based on the volatility, right? And then why would any blockchain company want to do business with somebody outside, like to say a lawyer or an accountant who's not on board with blockchain or with what the company has to kind of put up with at the time? Like, why does it matter?
So yeah, let me start with the second point about why would companies want to do that. So, you know, while everybody's working to innovate in this kind of blockchain-based financial ecosystem, the reality is that we still have to do business in the real world, quote unquote, right?
Right.
You know, I still have to pay my rent in cash.
Yes.
I still have to pay my, like, not all lawyers are Silicon Valley lawyers who are willing to take crypto, right?
Right.
Especially because it is so volatile, right? They need more stability in terms of their accounting. So for that reason, I mean, yeah, you have to have a way to easily transition that crypto into cash. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to the banking issue, right? So why would a bank not want to work with a blockchain company? And it's really around AML compliance questions, right? How do you prove the source of those funds? How do you show that wasn't derived from any sort of illegal activity?
Right.
And lots of banks don't understand blockchain well enough to know what a good AML program looks like, right? Mm-hmm. So having to educate them and then also demonstrably prove that your AML policy is sound is the biggest challenge. And if you think about it, most companies that are doing an ICO or most companies that are building a blockchain project, they don't really have the resources or the compliance know-how to prove that to a bank just to open an account, right?
Right.
So that's, do they, I mean, basically we want to build that kind of compliance framework and then bring on our customers through that same framework in a way that we can prove to our banks that the money is safe and there's little banking risk.
Let's just say I go through an ICO and say I have a realistic ICO raise. The ICO closes and I reach my hard cap and now I have 100 million trillion F because that's what's needed.
Right.
So I go to Chase Bank to open a business account, and they tell me, no way. So I come to you and I say, I have all this ETH. What can I do with it that I can't do with a bank? I guess, what can I do with you that I can't do?
We'd open your account, right, and say, hey, welcome to Formosa Financial. Here's your account details, right? And here's your deposit address. And that deposit address could be in whatever crypto you raised in. That could be ETH, XRP, Bitcoin, whatever you're holding. You want to make a deposit, that's what you send it to us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we're going to have a brokerage service connected to different OTCs, connected to different exchanges. And that'll give you a seamless way to take some of that crypto and turn it into a cash deposit, right? So once you have that cash in there, then you can move that cash in or out like you would make a payment, either to your lawyer, to a developer, or even just hold that cash there kind of as a savings account.
So how's the crypto safe?
So we partnered with the best-in-class institutional custody provider, a very long track record of working with exchanges, hedge funds, even blockchain companies themselves to keep the crypto safe. So they've got really solid multi-signature wallet procedures, different ways of managing hot and cold wallets. So by working with them, integrating it to the Formosa platform, you can be pretty sure your crypto is safe. And it's even verifiable if you were to look at the blockchain and look at your addresses.
I've never raised an ICO, right? And mm-hmm. to the extent of my business experience is small businesses, right? So I've never dabbled in hundreds of millions of dollars personally.
Mm.
And my mind can't wrap around what makes liquidity different, needing like 25 exchanges when, let's just say, for example, mm-hmm. I raise all my ETH and let's just say that's in a Coinbase account, right? Because Coinbase is safe. And they can just pull cash out when they need, right? You just click withdraw and it's going to go to your USD. Why wouldn't somebody just use Coinbase to begin with if their concern is pulling out large amounts of money?
You certainly could do that. I think if you're a cost-conscious CEO or a cost-conscious startup founder, you're going to want to get as much bang for your buck as possible.
For sure.
And by integrating to a number of exchanges, you can prevent what's called order book slippage. Is that a phrase you're familiar with? I can explain
sir.
It. So order book slippage is the idea that if I'm trying to submit a very large sell order, I can actually move the market if it's not a particularly high volume trading day or particularly liquid order book.
Okay.
So if I were trying to move, say, 10,000 Ethereum in one sitting, right? That can move the market down 5%, depending where I'm trading, right? But if I were to take that 10,000 Ethereum order and chop it up into 5 2,000 Ethereum pieces, then I can actually keep the price across all those exchanges roughly the same, and ultimately my cost savings would be that amount that I didn't move the order book mm-hmm. because I prevented slippage by doing that.
Well, I appreciate you answering that. And once you said that, that makes a lot of sense when you talk about, you know, so-and-so dumped X amount of coins and it moved the market X percent. That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. And,
but I got one more question, an ignorant question, I guess it is for me. I understood on the surface what you guys are doing with the risk management protocol, right? So let's just say I have my pile of ETH, and how do I know that ETH is going to be worth $100 trillion, you know, 20 years from now? And you guys have protocols in place to try to make that stay there, or to diversify or reallocate some of those assets so that it is safe and stable. And the first question that came up into my mind is, why not USD Tether?
Yeah, you certainly could. I mean, personally, I wouldn't be comfortable with the counterparty risk of holding Tether, given some of the questions swirling around it. But I think there's a lot of different methods to maintain effective risk management. So actually, one of the first things that we've done on the risk management front is we partnered with a group called Compound Protocol. Are you familiar with them?
No, sir.
So Compound Protocol, also based in Silicon Valley, backed by Andreessen Horowitz, Polychain, some of the bigger names in the crypto investment space. And they're building algorithmic money markets on the Ethereum blockchain. So what this lets our customers do is they can actually lend out their excess ETH and earn interest on it, which is fantastic, right? Because you think about when you park your money in a bank account, you're going to get a little bit of interest. So that, you know, kind of reduces any risk from inflation, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in crypto, obviously, it's much more volatile. So you have to earn a good amount of interest to kind of hedge that risk away. But it certainly helps that you can actually accrue additional Ether just in case the US dollar value of your Ether drops significantly.
Yeah.
So, we just actually announced that. They announced that partnership on Friday. We're going to have some follow-up announcements this coming week. So excited to work with them.
Look, I'm playing devil's advocate when I ask these questions, right? Because my general mind is, I'm a simple guy. I also recognize my weaknesses in business acumen and when it comes to bigger businesses, bigger capital raises. So when I saw your company, I get that there has to be a financial services for blockchain companies at the moment, right? So I appreciate you answering those questions.
Of course, here to educate. Yeah.
And we're definitely 101. So talk about your payment services solution and talk about the banking partnerships in general. How does it work? So they come to Formosa Financial and you guys have a relationship with these banks. And basically this bank is trusting you to say, hey, this company that we're banking with, this blockchain company, they're legit. And here's why. And so you guys have to educate the bank on why they should use you. And then you have to have that credibility behind you. And then you are taking on a company. You need some of however that partnership works. We need liquidity. We need fiat, et cetera. Can you talk about how that partnership works and why it's so important?
Well, so it's really the foundation of what we're building, right? So, you know, going back to your question earlier about how do you keep the crypto safe? Well, there's also the question, how do you keep the fiat safe, right?
That's right.
And the way you do that is through a bank. That's like the custodial partner on the fiat side. Mm. The real thing, so there's a couple key considerations for the bank. The first we've already talked about is the AML compliance. So how do they make sure the crypto that we're turning into cash, how is that all safe? How is that, how are we sure that's not, you know, dirty money? So we have to build a really robust AML compliance program to assuage those fears at the bank. Yeah. The second major area that many banks are worried about in the crypto space is more business risk. So how do they, a lot of US dollar payments internationally are cleared by correspondent banks.
Right.
So this is actually one of the problems that Tether ran into when they were banking with some banks in Taiwan. And when the correspondent bank of KGI in Taiwan found out that those US dollars were going into a crypto exchange, they cut off the correspondent relationship. So basically being very clear on what the limits are with the bank and knowing what who their correspondent is and what their expected payments volume is and how you go about doing that, that can minimize a lot of the business risk to your bank partner. So we're very focused on understanding those limits and then also building out a network of bank partners where we can effectively limit the risk.
Presumably the bank partners that you would have to have a bunch of them across the world, right?
That helps, certainly. And there's also, you know, a handful of banks that already work with crypto exchanges. And you think about you know, what the banking needs of an exchange are for fiat to crypto. And that's much more high risk than even what we're doing, right? Because there's, you know, thousands of individual accounts that are coming in. That just creates more risk, right? Versus what we're doing, where we have, you know, maybe 10 to a couple hundred corporate clients, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very kind of different type of KYC process that you need to conduct on a company versus an individual.
Right.
So by actually opening accounts at the banks where the exchanges already bank, that's another way to limit the risk really well.
So what if a USA blockchain-based company does an ICO or does an STO? They register with the SEC. They have their crypto, but the U.S. banks still won't bank with them. They come to you. You're in Taiwan. Can they come to you in Taiwan? Can Taiwan have a relationship with a United States blockchain company?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's actually a whole sector of Taiwan's financial sector, which is focused on offshore banking for international companies. We basically can open an account or custody fiat currency for international companies in any currency but Taiwan dollar. So that's kind of one of the main advantages that we're proposing in this platform.
And what's the user interaction in terms of if I'm a company and I'm in the United States or I'm in China or I'm in wherever I'm at in Europe, how do I have access to you guys? Like, how's your customer support structure going to be?
It'd be kind of like you're registering for an exchange account, right? So you open up the account, we ask you a series of questions. You know, where is your company incorporated? Who are the beneficial owners? What is the company's background? How did you guys raise the money, right? So kind of get some due diligence out of the way about the company's background and then go through that kind of customer onboarding process. And then from there, it's similar to the process I described of depositing the crypto, and we help you broker it into cash.
Okay. Pretty straightforward.
Yep.
Well, let's get into the token raise then. And I'd like to talk about your guys' timeline in that as well and the function of your guys' token. So let's talk with about the token function first. The FMF token has you guys have what's called a proof of membership mechanism. Can you talk about that? I thought that was really interesting, and especially when it comes to the security side of it.
Definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, having looked at a lot of token projects and their proposed economic models, I think the one that seems to most consistently kind of deliver value for all the stakeholders in a given ecosystem seems to be staking models, right?
Right.
So ones that incentivize participation or use of services by holding the token itself over a long period of time, right? Which prevents dumping and prevents all sorts of other activity that wouldn't be beneficial, right? So in our case, you think about what we're doing. We're building out a platform that connects the kind of crypto world to the fiat world, right? And on that crypto world, we're integrating a bunch of services. And on the fiat side, we're going to integrate a bunch of services. So kind of the way we want to, kind of work with high net worth customers or really high value add customers is have them stake our tokens and even pay for some of the services that we're going to offer in that token.
Okay.
And you can see that being a successful model for lots of the exchanges right now, right?
Yeah.
You look at Binance Coin, OKB. So we've kind of modeled our proof of membership token utility on those situations.
It seems to be the way it's going. And you guys had a two-phase rollout system. And with your guys' raise, it's roughly approximate 8 million soft cap to 16 million hard cap. Where does the roadmap swing one way or the other with the phases that you guys of the services you want to roll out?
Yeah, it can kind of swing with the market too. So we actually, to be clear on the raise, we successfully hit our hard cap at the end of May.
Oh, wow.
So
congratulations. That's awesome.
40,000 ETH. Yeah.
Great.
So,
So what's the roadmap then? So where are we going?
Oh, the roadmap. Okay. So, I mean, exciting stuff on the roadmap. So back to your kind of question about how does the banking partnerships work and all that stuff. So we've actually secured a license to operate a virtual currency exchange.
Awesome.
So not that we're getting into the exchange business, but what I was saying earlier about how we can integrate to all the exchanges, how we can go from crypto to fiat, that's super, super relevant to the type of business we're trying to operate. So basically, since we closed that raise, that's the direction we've gone on the phases, and now we're building out the technology platform to support that integration of the crypto custodial through that institutional custody partner, along with the bank partnerships that we've established, along with this kind of stuff that we're doing at the tech platform, like with Compound Protocol and some other people we're working with. So I'd say on the phases, we're like, you know, getting deeper into phase one, moving towards phase two as we kind of get more operational.
Well, I mean, once you put the capital raise behind you, it has to feel good. How did it feel when you guys hit the hard cap?
Oh, it was exuberant. It was fantastic. Yeah, it was a good, solid, 3-4 months of work, just nose to the grindstone, keep going, keep talking to people, believe in the project. We have really strong backers, like great investors that are connecting us to other people in the space. So we're super lucky to have them on board. And then now we're kind of in this middle phase where we're deciding when to list the token, where to list the token. Given the market conditions aren't very good right now, we're in a bit of a holding pattern. Mm-hmm. But that's the next big kind of milestone for us, in addition to all the work that we're doing on the platform and partnership side.
Man, that's great. So look, I want to conclude by asking you personally some questions that I asked at the end of my preview. And like I said, I'm just curious how your team sees the future. I see where the business needs are today.
Yeah.
How long do you guys think you're going to be able to survive as a company once the current conditions in crypto change? What happens when companies start paying their employees in crypto? What happens when there is so much money in the market that liquidity isn't an issue anymore? And what happens when stablecoins take off and your guys' risk management protocol isn't that big of an issue or needed to hedge against crypto market volatility? Where do you guys see Formosa Financial in the next 10 years? How do
you adapt? So I think, yeah, you rightfully bring up the fact that the market is changing very quickly. But having said all that, I think the services that we're offering are core services that aren't easily integrated into kind of a one-stop shop. So we feel like there will always be a need to keep safe custody of crypto and fiat.
For sure.
We always feel like there will be a need to move back and forth between those asset classes. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily just on a singular exchange, right? It's a global business. There's exchanges with different advantages, different levels of safety, different trading fees. So by integrating our business into them, we can really offer wholesale rates, which is something individuals wouldn't be able to get themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So we kind of see that as one of the core advantages of what we're building. And then in the future, yeah, the market and the conditions are going to keep changing. But we feel by serving clients who have immediate needs, we're going to keep understanding and evolving our risk management offering to kind of meet the needs of the market at that time. So hard to say exactly where we're going, but I'd say, we have a pretty deep level of experience on multiple layers of the system. And, you know, it's hard to replicate that know-how. So we'll see where the market goes, but we're excited to keep working on it.
Well, I appreciate you answering that question. And so where can people learn more about you guys? What are you looking for with the community? You guys are trying to get the word out. You guys are on ICO 101, but you've hit your hard cap. What are you looking for from the community?
Yeah, so I think we're interested in, bringing people in who are interested in kind of these fundamental issues of both on the crypto side, like what are the coolest innovations in blockchain? Which projects really fit into the vision that we have of providing these services for companies in the space? Mm-hmm. So like people who are more interested in like some of the B2B considerations, the global policy considerations, and the tech stuff too. So people who are interested in those conversations, I encourage you guys to join our Telegram. We've got great community management group, just interesting conversations happening around the space.
For sure. Yeah, I'm in your guys' Telegram as well. It's a good group. I like it.
Thank you.
Ryan, thanks so much for being on ICO 101. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you answering the questions, and let's keep in touch.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Yo, everyone. Thanks again for listening. If you enjoyed the show, then check out the links on the show notes. And don't forget to subscribe to ICO 101 Podcast by going to the Crypto 101 Podcast feed that is found on iTunes, SoundCloud, and CastBox, and leave a positive review. Please follow me on Twitter @SupAaronPaul, and don't forget to follow the podcast on Twitter as well @ICO101Podcast. Until next time, peace.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.